Evening and welcome to the fourth edition of the Profiles in Performance podcast. I'm absolutely delighted to say that this week we have Simon Rowlands on board. Simon is by far and away the most requested guest I've had for the podcast. And speaking from my own perspective, his writing and his work, particularly on sectional times, but on other things as well, has been the single biggest influence on my own work, and he's played a pretty major role in getting me really deeply interested in racing, cementing that interest in racing, and also getting me to a stage where I'm doing this full time. So, I mean, it really, to have him on here today is a privilege, and I know, as I say, that he was a guest that was just about at the top of everybody's list. So, I mean, most of you will know at least a little about Simon, but Simon, do you just want to take 90 seconds or so to talk a little bit about your background in racing and where you are at in your career at the moment?
Yeah, thanks very much, Will, and after that build up I hope I don't disappoint. That's very flattering. I've really enjoyed the performance podcasts to this stage. They've been very enlightening and strike just the right sort of tone. I hope I can continue the good run. My background in racing, I'm from a non-racing background, but I was, even at a young age, fascinated by numbers. And back in those days, the daily papers had race cards in them with numbers, etc. And that was the thing that probably got me interested in the first place, what was going on behind all those figures. I was then interested by the spectacle of racing back in the days of Red Rum and the like, and but I think the moment of epiphany, I suppose it was on my 11th birthday, being given a form book by my parents, who'd run out of ideas of what to get me for a present, but it was inspired, because in that form book, which was an offshoot of Time Form, there were ratings, and the horses of the big numbers were better than the horses of the small numbers. And that got me absolutely gripped. Started running my own handicap and time analysis when I was a teenager. Very badly, when I look back upon it. That's not how I saw it at the time. Went to university, wrote to Time Form when I was still at school saying I wanted a job there. After university, worked briefly at a bookmaker's, because back in those days, it was the only way of keeping in touch with the sport, which wasn't televised. Joined Time Form in the mid-80s, and at Time Form I did handicapping, essay writing, race reading, that sort of thing. Overlapped with the true legend of the sport, Phil Bull, for a couple of years. Fast-forwarding 15-odd years, I made the majority of my money out of betting. In the early days of Betfair, I did do a little bit of stuff on the side. I was primarily in the place markets and laying, I suppose, and it was around understanding the correct prices of horses, or so I thought anyway. But I was tapped up to join a national newspaper rival to the Racing Post, which didn't last very long, but I was racing editor there. After that, I went to Betfair and launched their radio service, which became Time Form Radio afterwards. Drifted back to Time Form, where I blogged extensively, notably about sectional timing, but also about other things. I helped them at Time Form to automate a lot of their procedures around ratings and betting tissues and things like that. But in the last 3 years, I've been freelance and currently work primarily for At the Races, the Irish Field, done blogs for the Hong Kong Jockey Club, International Thoroughbred, and still retain an involvement with Time Form.
Excellent.
I would emphasize, actually, at the outset, that I'm not a pro punter, even though I briefly possibly could be described as such 15-odd years ago. I do make money from betting, but it's fairly small scale. Unlike your previous guests and probably some of your future ones, I wouldn't claim to be currently a massive success at betting. The thing that's always inspired me is really analysis and writing, and in that respect, I suppose I've ended up in quite a good place.
No, it's excellent. And I mean, speaking for myself, and I'm sure plenty of listeners, the At the Races blogs have been an excellent. And I know you're, and although I don't subscribe to it, the Irish Field articles.
Why not, Will?
I'll sometimes steal them if people are good enough to post enlarged pictures of them. I'll read them then, but I have to confess I don't subscribe for my own indulgence. And we haven't discussed this beforehand. What was it like overlapping with Phil Boole at Time Form? I mean, as you say, he really is the, certainly for people interested in sectional times, really is the god from which everything flows.
He's the guy who he made the equivalent of several million pounds out of betting back in the day. He found that doing all the hard work was too much, and he started a company, which was Timeform. That's over 70 years ago now. And I think Timeform's been his, undoubtedly his greatest legacy, in that it's continued to employ, you know, countless people who've gone on also after Timeform to make a big impact in horse racing. But the kind of formalised, evidence-based analysis of both time and form, it originates really from Phil Boole. Overlapping with him a couple of years, I didn't have a huge amount of dealings with him. He was in his late 70s at the time. But remember going to a race meeting at Haydock in about 1987 or something like that, and I was where Timeform had a box, and there were only three of us in the box. One was Phil Boole, the other was Alex Bird, who was an even bigger professional punter, and the other was me. And we found that we all fancied this one horse in a race. Phil Boole had £1,000 on it. Alex Bird had £2,000 on it. He turned to me and said, "Do you want a bet?" And I thought, I was being paid tuppence halfpenny at the time, and I thought, I'll push the boat out a bit. Could I have £20 on, please? Which, it got beat as well. So, not a particularly self-serving anecdote, but it was, Phil Boole, frankly, is my mentor, I suppose. Certainly the person that I think has had the most beneficial effect on my career, even though we didn't actually have all that many dealings with one another, I suppose.
But no, even to meet him in your early days must have been definitely a bit of a buzz. He's from my own perspective. Yeah. I mean, obviously, I was born, I think, after he died, but he is still regarded as a legend. And that brings us nicely into the topic, or the primary topic today, which, as people will have guessed, will be sectional times. I'd be keen, and we've discussed this briefly beforehand, to basically break the podcast down into two parts. The first part being kind of process focused, where we talk about the process of collecting times, breaking them down into sectionals, extrapolating the data. And then the second part of the podcast would be their practical application, which is basically using that information, which is extrapolated to improve your punting, part of your form study, your selection process. Because a lot of, particularly part one, is quite data heavy, I'll probably make reference on several occasions to, and certainly for me this is a bit of a bible, the sectional timing by time form piece that I think you wrote kind of in your last year or two at time form is that correct, Simon?
Yeah, it's a free to download thing, and it's still out there on the internet. Sectional timing and introduction by Timeform.
And I'll post a link to that when I post the podcast to give people a kind of, because I think even having that open and having that, you know, a basic idea of that will be helpful for a lot of what we discuss. Do you want to talk a little bit about when you're sitting at home watching racing each day, how you would go about timing races, how you would go about breaking them down, and how easily that can be replicated by others in their own homes?
Yeah, sure. It's perfectly possible to take accurate sectionals under most circumstances just using TV pictures and a stopwatch. That's the way I've done it for the majority of the time. And especially more recently with At the Races having an on-screen clock, so when you pause it, you get a time maybe halfway through the race, and then you can subtract that from the time when you pause it at the finish. So they've made it a lot easier in that respect. However, more recently, where possible, I capture a video, such as from YouTube, but there are ways of capturing videos from normal TV coverage. Process it using a sports science derived software called Kinovia, K-I-N-O-V-E-A. That allows you to do all manner of things with the video, in addition to just pausing, slow motion, superimposing clocks, superimposing lines across the course, and all those kind of things, dual screen as well if you want to do that, which means that you can properly deconstruct a race if you wish. Also, and I don't know whether we'll deal with this at all, but you can do striding metrics from that by slowing the pictures down, counting the strides that a horse takes, and being able to calculate from the information available how quickly the horse strides and how long its stride is, which increasingly is looking a worthwhile area of study in not just horse racing, but in buying horses, such as at Breeze Up Sales. So with Kinovia, ideally, but sometimes just with ordinary TV pictures and stopwatches, you can establish how quickly individual horses, but also the race in general, has progressed at various stages. Sometimes you need to be quite inventive with sectionals if you're trying to get accurate sectionals. Sometimes you might only see horses when they've gone a few lengths past a sectional, and I think it's perfectly legitimate to estimate how much time has lapsed between them passing the actual sectional and it coming into view. In many cases, that's pretty easy to get right to within 0.1 of a second or something like that. I've used things like marks on the ground, paths, crossings at race courses, so things like that. I then process, it's not that difficult to actually just knock up an Excel spreadsheet to do this, input the values, margins back of horses at sectionals and convert that into times and come up with individual sectionals. That's how I did it sort of 15, 20 years ago. But I do have an app that converts stuff like that now and makes it quicker and more seamless. So
And when you're going about that, clearly this will depend on, because I know for the top class races you'll look at every horse in the race, but if you're taking, say, a mundane kind of race during the week, do you time the winner throughout, or do you time the leader and then the winner at the line, or do you still make the effort to time every horse in a particular race?
A good question, that. I suppose generally I will do both of the first two, which is you'll time the leader passing a sectional and then the leader passing the line, and the leader passing the line is the winner, obviously, and they're not necessarily the same horse. But that will give you, as we'll come on to with sort of finishing speed measures, that'll give you an idea of the general, whether the race was well run, slowly run, overly strongly run, etc. But I'll normally identify where the winner was at the sectional, and if it was three lengths back, it depends on what sort of speed the horses are travelling, but if it was 3 to 4 lengths back, it's around about half a second. Believe me, I'm a little bit more accurate about these things. I'm just trying to give the general impression. Then obviously, if say the race sectional was 36 seconds, but the winner was half a second back, it's run the concluding sectional in 35.5 seconds. Yeah. That will prompt a different sort of finishing speed figure, but you can learn an awful lot Without going into great detail, and you don't need to go into individual horses in every instance, you can learn a lot about whether a racer's favoured horses that have got stamina or horses who have been up with the pace, etc., simply by just taking that one-off sectional for the leader around about 3 furlongs from home on the flat and 3 obstacles from home over jumps, ideally, the laps between that and the finish.
And clearly, I mean, and again, this tends to be, I assume, something you only do for the kind of very top class races. The gold standard would be a situation where you could time horses furlong by furlong. And I know, I think maybe it was with Frankel's 2000 guineas when I've certainly read something you did on that. But generally speaking, you know, that's not necessary to give you a, you know, as you say, the 3 furlong point tends to be the standard point with which to calculate, say, a finishing speed. But if you could, in a dream world, I take it a furlong by furlong breakdown would be even more accurate and would kind of deepen insight.
Absolutely. And I do it a little bit more often, certainly when I've got it races in video editing software, it doesn't add much to the time to do that. What I would say, though, is that the real sort of quantum leap, if you like, is when between overall race times, which can sometimes be very useful, but fairly often misleading in terms of quantifying a horse's ability. The quantum leap really is to break it down into the race into two parts. The closing sectional will imply what happened before that. So if the closing sectional is fast compared to the horse's overall time, then clearly what came before it was slow compared to the horse's overall time. So the really important thing is to maybe not make it multi-dimensional, but to make it two-dimensional by introducing at least one sectional along the way. I do take individual furlong sectionals, and I think the information I gather may be of use in the future, but for the time being, that's largely for interest, really, to see, for instance, that Too Darn Hot ran an 11.7 second sectional early in the straight at Sandown. Helps me to understand that the horse is not quite as slow as, well, not slow, not quite as much of a stamina proposition as some people are making out, so... But in terms of sort of quantifying his performance, the most important thing for me is to take at least one sectional and to flesh out the performance as a result.
And that's clearly something that, and speaking from my own experience, the point where you take the sectional is very, depends very much on things like clear furlong markers and camera angles, which are conducive to, I know, having using Timeform a lot, I think Hamilton Park, which is fairly nearby to where I stay, they tend to struggle to have accurate finishing speeds there, certainly for sprint races. And I assume the reason for that is because there's a lack of discernible furlong markers, or the camera angle is you know, not really conducive to doing so.
Yeah, that's right. It's generally fairly easy at the far rail at Hamilton to see the furlong markers, but not on the stand rail, and most sprint races take place, unfold on the stands rail at Hamilton. The 3 furlong marker, essentially I did a big survey of all the turf tracks data from all the all-weather courses for over a 4-year period about 10 years ago, and I established absolutely categorically that if you could only take one sectional, the best sectional to take was around about 25% to 35% from the finish. And that just happens to be, well, it's probably no coincidence that tends to be where cameras are placed, because that tends to be where things start to happen in horse races. So 3 furlongs out in a 10-furlong race, 2 furlongs out in a 6-furlong race, tends to be really kind of the most crucial stage of the race, and if you can capture what happens after that, it implies what has occurred before it. And occasionally, particularly at longer distances, you things like the Derby and races like that, you can miss nuances in what occurred earlier on, but as a starting point for tackling sectionals, going for three furlongs out, three obstacles from home over jumps, is not just convenient, but also has great merit in terms of what it will tell you about the data overall.
Yeah, no, that tends to be the point in which, certainly from my own perspective, I use. So when you've accumulated that data, you've broken the race down, as you say, into two or perhaps more parts. Is it at that point that you would start to you would use that information to calculate, say, a finishing speed, to calculate the kind of pace that they've gone in the race?
Yeah, and obviously in Excel spreadsheets or other ways of doing it, that's a seamless process as well. Finishing speed percentage, there's a number of ways, many ways, almost infinite number of ways in which sectionals could be expressed. And I think for the view in public, things like how many lengths quicker or slower than par might be the kind of thing that will catch on eventually. But finishing speed percentages give you a simple how quick was the end of a race compared to the race overall. And by how quick, I mean, what was the speed? So that anything over 100% at the end means they're finishing quicker than the average race speed for the race overall. And anything below 100% means they're finishing slower. In many instances, I had a quick look before this call. The average for flat racing, average par figure for flat racing in Britain and Ireland is 101.3%. So it's pretty close to 100%. So if you see a figure which says 110% finish, you know that in nearly every instance, that will be a really quick finish. And all the implications thereof, the horses come from behind has done so despite the pace, having to quicken into a quickening pace. And similarly, a figure of, 95% or below will be indicative of them plodding home, and anything that's been up with the pace has possibly, probably done reasonably well. It does differ, as you would expect, by the distance of the race and particularly by the nature of the course. So at one extreme, you've got Carlisle, which I believe the par finishing speed figures are around about 95% at longer distances, so you expect horses to finish more slowly than their average race speed. And at the other extreme is the Derby at Epsom, where the par is 111%. So they go uphill, then round bends, and only in the straight, which is downhill, do they really take off, and you would expect horses to be finishing quickly then. The important thing to do then is to compare the individual finishing speed percentages of the horses with that par. Now, those pars aren't generally made widely available. There's a lot of sort of intellectual property gone into them, but you can figure them out if you do things like subscribe to Typeform Sectional Archive, where there's an awful lot of information there. Or you can compile them yourself under circumstances that you're particularly interested in. And then it's a question of trading off the difference between a horse's individual finishing speed and that par to establish how much quicker, in theory, the horse could have run if the whole race and its own performance had have been more efficient and truly run.
Yeah, I think that's a succinct summation. I mean, it's clearly not a formula that we really, or it's not particularly helpful to get into on here, but I think the aforementioned sectional timing introduction that you wrote has all the information in terms of what you need to calculate your own finishing speeds. Is that correct?
Yeah, and how to upgrade performances compared to sectional pars. But it's a fairly dull equation, and I won't inflict it on anybody here, but it is out there in the public domain.
And from your own perspective, once you've calculated finishing speeds, would that be the point when you start looking at the individual horses in the race and how that the pace of the race derived from the finishing speeds would have perhaps impacted on their performance?
Yes, although, I mean, I do, for instance, this summer I've found that there's a lot of merit in doing that with French racing, where they have on-screen sectionals and it's fairly quick process to number crunch and find out which horses have done well and which horses have not over there. Generally speaking, I just feed my own sectionals. I look at Timeform's sectional archive as well and feed that into the process of basically trying to identify horses who were either better than, or if you like, worse than the result in a race. Better than horses, you know, get big upgrades, who've overcome adversity or failed to overcome but done pretty well, but also horses who've had the run of the race, which might not be entirely apparent just by watching the race visually. Winners who have run perfectly efficiently but have had horses snapping at their heels who've had far less of the run of the race. So I feed that into... I don't do an awful lot of that manually, some of it manually, but I feed that into the process, which then comes out the other end and flags up to me horses that may be of interest or the opposite.
And would you, in doing that, would you, certainly for your kind of flagship work, which tends to be on the kind of better quality stuff, you would quite often have like a spreadsheet where you would give the rating and then the upgrade, i.e., you know, for a horse who's perhaps come third, having been held up in rear against a pace bias, do you always convert that into data, i.e., would you always use that information to, you know, to give like a precise number, a precise kind of sectional upgrade, or would you sometimes be enough to just know that, you know, that horse perhaps, you know, didn't get the run of the race and is better than the bare result?
The majority of the time I'll try and convert it into a figure. I think it's useful, always useful, to have something grounded in numbers, even if many other factors obviously come into why horses win or lose races than simple ability and simple sectionals. So I'll try and put a figure on it. I've always really tried to put figures on performances, whether they're form-derived or time-derived over the years. But, occasionally, we've all only got a finite amount of time, and you cut your cloth according to your needs, really, and occasionally I'll just be happy to be aware that a race might be false form or that a winner has perhaps stolen a little bit from the front, and I'll only sort of revisit that at length if it's something that I feel is particularly relevant further down the line.
Yeah, I think that's certainly a similar process to the one I take as well. Whilst we're focusing on process, you mentioned, and this wasn't part of our original plan, but it's something that interests me, and I think if you're interested in this podcast, you'll probably be interested in it as well. Do you want to talk briefly about, and I know it'll be kind of a similar process in deriving that data, striding length and the process of collecting that and how that information, I mean, I know it's, I know fairly little about it. I know it's kind of in its infancy, but how that kind of data can be used?
Yeah, it's in its infancy with me as well. The kind of real watershed, in a way, was when Total Performance Data, who provide sectionals for display on the At The Races results website, introduced striding. I wouldn't say it was new to me, because I'd done some work in this area on purchasing breeze-up horses based on how quickly and how well they strode, and you know, that's been going on for several years, certainly in the area of bloodstock purchases. But I'd not had a great deal of data to go at prior to that. A horse's speed is quite simply a function of how long its stride is and how frequently it strides. It's as simple as that. But therein also lies a lot of nuance and everything. A horse's stride length will vary according to whether it's running uphill or downhill, whether the ground is soft or firm, whether it's getting traction, whether it's going around bends, and, of course, how good it is. Really good horses tend to have long strides. In fact, I'm not sure any really good horse has not had at least an above-average stride length. What I've found more recently is that cadence, which is stride frequency, is actually probably a little bit easier to isolate, and that, not that surprisingly when you think about it, and if you compare it with human athletes, horses who are sprinters tend not to relax and they stride very quickly. Horses who stay relax, they're capable of upping their stride frequency, but perhaps the feature of the way they perform is that they switch off. And all of that can be spotted either through things like the TPD data or gathering it yourself. I've only kind of done very ad hoc measurements, and there's something in my blog which has gone out this week on At the Races about striding, including horses like Sangarius, who I suspect may be a real star of the future. Once raced, once winning horse at Newmarket last month. He's got a really long stride. The way I derived that was by putting a video into video editing software, establish the sectionals, what speed the horse is going at various stages of the race. And thereafter, it's a simple matter of slowing the video down and counting the number of strides a horse takes in either an entire furlong or a sample of that furlong. And from that, you can derive how many times a second a horse is striding, with sprinters often striding around about 2.4, 2.5 times a second, stayers nearer 2.2, or over jumps is around about 2 strides a second. And from that, it's a fairly simple piece of arithmetic to figure out how long a horse's stride was, because, as I say, a time that a horse takes to run is a product of stride length and stride frequency.
And in terms of the value of that data, I mean, again, and this is speaking in very layman terms, I remember reading a blog, I think you did, I assume it was on At the Races, around the time, I think that Justify, who was the Triple Crown winner, was going for is it the Belmont is the third element?
That's right, yeah.
And
I had my doubts whether he was going to last out the distance. He dismissed them pretty summarily.
But in terms of, I mean, in general terms, do you think that is could perhaps be the primary value of the data in terms of identifying horses' ideal trips or whether horses are likely to stay a trip?
I think it is at this stage. There's all sorts of things you can do in this area, but it seems to me, and I haven't proved it absolutely categorically, but I've looked into the data quite a bit, seems to me that the frequency with which a horse strides is more hardwired, and I think human athletes would identify with this as well, is more hardwired into a horse, and it's less prone to circumstances like changes in going, etc. A horse will tend to stride with a certain frequency, and that will limit how far a horse will be able to carry its ability, really. So there are complicated matters. In the blog that I wrote this week, I've identified that another horse, King of Comedy, actually strode very quickly on his debut, but if you look at it, that video, its legs are going all over the place, and I think it's a function of greenness, and I wouldn't want to make hard and fast conclusions about horses very early in their career, but I certainly think later on, and I'll quote an example that I think may reflect reasonably well on it, is was Saxon Warrior, who had the striding pattern of a mile to mile and quarter horse. We knew that after the Racing Post Trophy. People talked him up as being a possible Triple Crown winner, which would have involved the St. Ledger ultimately. I had my doubts about whether he would even get a mile and a half. I don't think that's been proved conclusively, obviously. He finished third in a what was admittedly a slowly run Irish Derby, and fourth, was it, in the Derby at Epsom.
Yeah.
So he's obviously capable of reasonable form at a mile and a half, but they've dropped him back in trip, and he's beginning to look like a mile and a quarter horse, which is exactly the sort of signature, if you like, of his striding as a two-year-old, and not just as a very green early two-year-old, but when he was more the finished article as well. So I think it's an interesting area, and it comes out of the same sort of processes of collecting sectional times. It's not that much of a great deal more effort to look into those kind of things, and hopefully a year or two down the line we'll be a lot more au fait with what it's all about, but there's definitely something there.
Absolutely. No, I agree. It's certainly, I mean, I know very little about it, but it's certainly of interest to me. One more question on it. Is it something that people were utilising? You mentioned briefly about breeze-up horses. Is it something that people were already utilising in that area?
Yeah, definitely. Although in Britain, probably not for all that long. But I did meet somebody from America who's been doing this with a PhD student for several years and buying horses on the back of it, and they take it much further, and things like inflection of the knee. So it's about not just about striding length and striding frequency, but how a horse strides, whether it shows knee action, which anecdotally has always had a correlation with effectiveness on different types of ground, as you would probably expect. So yeah, it's been dealt with in bloodstock areas, yearling sales, breeze up sales, things like that, for a while. But I still think having access to the kind of data the TPD provides takes it onto a different level, really.
Yeah, no, it's certainly something that, I guess it's one step at a time when we're struggling to get even sectional data readily available. But you'd hope that people would recognise its value, and it would become kind of part of the discourse in the future.
Yeah.
So, having talked about the process of the collection of the data and how you can use that, I think it's important we move on now to talk about its practical application, because I think for everybody listening to this, it's you know, the process is interesting, but I suppose from your own perspectives, knowing how to apply that kind of information into your form study and your selection process is, I guess, of paramount importance. How would you day-to-day, Simon, I don't know if this is something that's well known, you have a background really as a form handicapper, which I wonder might surprise people, because there seems to incorrectly be a perception that and I guess that's possibly fueled by the fact that because it's an area of expertise, you are generally paid to write about sectional timing, but your background really comes from just pure form handicapping. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. I regard that's the area of my real expertise, I think. Sectionals is an area which is we're all still discovering about, and I'm finding it fascinating. But I mean, the point throughout, and the reason why Phil Bull termed time form rather than time or form, was that the two go hand in hand. They you need to know about time analysis to do form analysis well, and you need to know about form analysis to do time analysis well. I'm absolutely sure about that. One of the things about sectional times is that you can occasionally, although less so nowadays than maybe 5 years ago, come across a horse who's massively better than is generally appreciated. And you can quantify it in a way that you can be sort of confident that the horse has got a winning chance in a race. And in instances like that, I, you know, might not do an awful lot of other digging. I would obviously need to know that the horse in question is going to be suited by the circumstances, not going to be undone by the draw, or can't jump fences, or whatever it might be. But it sometimes can be pretty simple question of, this is a good horse, sectionals show it's a good horse, the public don't seem to appreciate that, and that leads you to a bet. But far more often it's just part of a wider process of drawing in all those things, of understanding what those sectionals mean in a wider context of form analysis and all the other factors that go into why horses run well or badly.
And I mean, how, from, and again, this is clearly a subjective element to this, but how much do you think that sectionals and time kind of based data is factored into the market? Do you think it's factored into the market more now than it was? Do you still think it's undervalued by the market, or are we kind of getting to a stage now where the market kind of, it takes cognizance of it and factors it into the price that people are offered when they bet on horses?
It's more factored in now than it used to be, and there are clearly plenty of people taking their own sectionals and using more publicly available sectionals. But it's still, I'm pretty confident, not factored in as much as it should be. There was a time, sort of five, six years ago, where it was possible to, I particularly noticed it on the all-weather, which obviously is a bit of a sort of a confined population of horses, where you could back horses with good sectionals at what seemed pretty decent prices. Shortly after that, those same horses were halving in price, which suggested that a lot of people were getting on the bandwagon really around that time. I think it's kind of found a little bit more of an equilibrium since then, because to be honest, many of those horses were being overbet because of sectionals a few years back. I think it's reached more of an equilibrium, but there's definitely still an edge to be had in knowing horses, not only horses that are better than the result, but horses who have been worse than the result in a way. It's undoubtedly a factor in certain punters backing, you know, influential punters backing horses. So it will feed into the market.
Yeah. I mean, I think you can point, and this is, you know, I mean, anecdotal, but I know Hugh Taylor, who is, I think, without question, certainly public in terms of, you know, having access to him publicly, the best tipster in the game. And his, if you read his analysis that he gives with his selections, it's rare that he has not factored sectionals or the pace of a race or like a notable time performance into his selection process. And I think that alone kind of gives you an idea. You know, I mean, clearly you're at a stage with him because he is so influential on the market where, you know, backing him at SP is no good. But if you're able to get the prices that he puts selections up at, you know, you're clearly doing extremely well out of it. And I don't really know him, but obviously it's impossible not to be aware of him. And he does seem to... you know, factor that very heavily into the process. So, I mean, that's clearly anecdotal, but I mean, the kind of horses he is backing, there is clearly value to be had at the prices he's putting them up. And I think that's, you know, there are similar kind of horses you can find to the ones that, you know, he's interested in backing. I mean, that's probably not something that's really, you know, that's kind of, there's a subjectivity to that, but it's certainly something he's interested in. So and I think we can all aspire to be as good as Hugh Taylor is at tipping up horses.
Yeah, that would be nice. That would be nice. I think one of the questions that cropped up when you posed this podcast on Twitter was, do I always take note of sectional times? The answer is, I suppose, yes. I always take note of them. It doesn't mean that my idea of value or my ultimate selection will be what could be termed a sectional horse, but I will always take note of it in the way that other people take note of, I don't know, official handicap ratings or time figures or something like that. And I think you are arguably selling yourself short if you don't. So obviously there are many different ways to skin this particular cat, and people do perfectly well without factoring in sectionals. But for myself, I always take note of them. And it, as you say, it sounds like Hugh Taylor does, and he's a tremendous example.
And in terms of, I mean, and kind of leading on from that, because you're primarily a form-based handicapper, and this is another question we were asked, how, because clearly, and again, I don't know what precise factors you take into account when analysing a race, but I'm sure things like ground, draw, run style, the quality of form all come into it. How easy do you find it when all these other factors you take into account point toward a bet, but say the clock, the sectional profile of a horse is perhaps less than flattering? Does that put you off? Would you ever bet on a horse who the clock perhaps suggested had been flattered or was perhaps poorer than what raw form was telling you?
Ever, yes. But not very often, I suppose. It's unlikely the horse who at sectionals and times suggests has been flattered is going to be a bigger price than it should be. But occasionally that kind of thing happens. And I will go against inverted commas sectional horses occasionally. To my cost at times, for instance, I thought at Sea of Class, tremendous late sectionals when winning the Irish Oaks. I went against her in the Yorkshire Oaks, and she took her performance to a higher level, but I didn't go against her because I thought her sectional sucked. I went against her because I thought her price sucked. Yeah. And that ultimately is all it comes down to, weighing up all these various factors, which you can do fairly mechanically or you can do fairly subjectively. I was really interested in your chat with Helpful Punter around compiling tissues and everything. And when I approach a race, I perhaps almost my first starting point is the time based and the sectional based and the, to a degree, the form ratings based background of the horse. But thereafter, I will do it subjectively in a way that's pretty familiar to most people, really. I'll isolate the races I'm interested in looking at, and I will try and appraise the strengths and weaknesses of horses, and I will price the race up nearly always. I think the exception are those times where I think a horse is just such a standout on sectionals or possibly other factors that I'm happy that it's going to be a good bet and that the public has assessed it in a way. But that generally I prefer to even then know what kind of price I feel it is. The whole process of drawing up a tissue, I think, is really good discipline. The horse who you thought might be worth backing at even money or any price odds against or something like that, once you actually really go through the nuts and bolts of all its opposition and everything, you might find that actually it's more like 2-1, and you would have been wrong to have just leapt in there.
Yeah. You mentioned briefly to me in a chat we had beforehand that you kind of have like an automated tissue price model that you use. Is that something you want to talk about a little?
I don't use it very much at the moment, but I did devise it, and I was just interested in the discussion about tissues. That I think there are elements where, borrowing from other disciplines of predictive disciplines, where you can formalise what you do quite a lot. The far and away the most useful piece of information, and I've had this confirmed by professional punters, if you can only have one piece of information about a horse's past, it's what price did it go off on its latest start, and what was the context of that latest start. So in simple terms, in an 11-runner handicap, if a horse goes off at 10-1, it's regarded as having an average chance, and it finishes in mid-division. If it then runs in another handicap under similar conditions without any great swing in its official mark, without various things about fitness and ground and everything changing greatly, then you could expect it to be going off a similar sort of price. And there's a way of formalising this, and it's of using the price that the horse went off in his most recent start, contextualising it through racehorse ratings, so that you know that the race it ran in last time was £10 better than the race it's running in today, and adjusting odds accordingly. I think I only kind of got part of the way in doing that when I was at Timeform. I think there's a lot of interesting research that could be done, and probably has been done by syndicates, into sort of formalising the tissue compiling thing based around odds and past odds and ratings, but also the wisdom of the crowd concept, whereby you get several different assessments of horses' probabilities of winning races, and you merge those together, weighting them according to how useful they are. So I've found that more so in the past. I don't work for Timeform now, but they have an element of that in forming their human tissue compilers, who do a very good job and improve the kind of mechanical delivery of prices. So there's potential in that respect. I don't use it all the time, but I still refer to it as a matter of interest, really. And I think there is potential in that area, but I still do it the old-fashioned way of, and I definitely price races up without knowing what the odds are, if I possibly can.
Yeah.
So I think I absolutely get what has been said previously about, you know, after a while you can be fairly oblivious to what other people's assessment of horses' odds are, but I think anchoring effects in human cognitive processes are pretty powerful. And if you were going to price a horse up at 4-1 and you see it at 7-4, you're probably going to go somewhere in between. And I'd rather have a fairly completely uncorrupted take on it and then start to doubt myself.
A couple of questions that I think kind of are good lead-ons from that, and they're pretty much linked. One of them's actually my question, one of them was another question that we received, which was that, are there certain types of races and conditions in races where you believe sectionals are more or less useful? And the example they've given, different distances, different tracks, different conditions. And the example that the question that I had that kind of is very similar is, do you find sectional data to be as useful in analysing two-year-old performance? Because from my own, having kept records, and from my own perspective, I find that, and I don't know exactly why this is, my hypothesis might be that because two-year-olds are developing continually, a performance from a month or two ago might not be an accurate barometer of where they're at now. But I certainly find that my own sectional data tends to be less useful for finding a bet in two-year-old races. I don't know what your view on those two questions are.
Yeah, more races are truly run at shorter distances than longer distances. There's a very clear effect there. So arguably sectionals would be more useful longer the distance of a race. That's not to say that all sprint races are truly run by any means. As against that, unless you're going to drill down into really detailed sectionals, you might miss important information in longer distance races more than you do in shorter. I haven't noticed a real difference there. Contrary to you, I tend to actually find that with when you get horses in maidens where there could be to talk ratings, there could be 110 horse in the field against a load of 70 rated horses. 110 rated horse doesn't win by 15 lengths. It wins by 2.5 lengths with a late burst of speed. I think that's really when sectionals really come into their own. But you're not the only one who's kind of figuring that out, either through sectionals or through visuals or just an understanding of the game. And so horses like Sangarius, who won last month, aren't going to be going off double the odds they should be because people have missed the fact that he's probably 110 horse running against 80 rated horses that day. Lots of people will be on to that. I think the really, really useful thing about sectionals, if you do take them seriously, is that they can quantify those kind of things pretty accurately as we get better with sort of the processes, and so that we know not just that when Calix made his debut, he's probably a group horse in the making, but he was probably 113 rated horse in the mating or making or thereabouts. And I think that's far more powerful to be able to quantify it in that respect, give or take a margin of error, and to price races up accordingly.
Do you find though that perhaps, and I don't know, and again you might disagree on this as well, that to take 2-year-olds as an example, they are less likely to replicate performances, and again you might have raw data which totally blows this out of the water. I sometimes find, and again this is one example, and I know you backed it and Hugh Taylor backed it and I backed it as well, it was the Mark Johnson horse at Ascot.
That's going, yeah.
Where and I think actually to be fair, in the case of that horse, I think it's actually left that performance behind. But is there something in 2-year-olds perhaps that makes them less likely to reliably replicate form?
I would need to look at the evidence. I would always need to look at the evidence, and I haven't got that to hand or
yeah,
looked at recently.
I've thrown that one at you. I feel bad about that.
I could give you my sort of hunch, which is that, if anything, I think that they're less jaded and more likely to run their race. The only thing is, as you identified, they're particularly dynamic. They're changing, getting better, sometimes getting worse, learning about the game. So there is that kind of uncertainty involved, but I tend to feel they're a bit more honest, actually.
Okay.
Provided they get the right kind of circumstance. An awful lot of tour races are tactical. You don't want to gun a horse from the front and when it's just a work in progress. So that all needs to be taken into account. But I'm particularly keen on tour races in establishing which of the horses are maybe really good, despite conventional ways of assessing them through time and form suggesting they may not be. I did mention earlier, I think if anybody were to specialise in this area, and I certainly wouldn't recommend trying to number crunch sectionals for every race that's ever been run, besides anything Time Form Sectional Archive does cover a lot of that anyway for you. Things like group races. It's surprising how often the media misreports things like the pace of races, both broadcast media and printed media. And I think group races can be a pretty good area of specialism to just look at races, deconstruct, find out whether they really did play to horses with stamina or speed, and whether that horse that came flying through at the finish was flattered or actually much better than it appeared. So I do, because one of my jobs is to do big race previews for At The Races, I'm kind of the yin to Hugh Taylor's yang a bit, because he loves tackling Wolverhampton races and the like. I tend to do the bigger races at weekends, and so I quite often looking at group races, and so a lot of my concentration has been on group races and really understanding what went on in those. And I kind of imagined that everybody would know exactly what was going on, but I'm increasingly feeling that they don't, and that sectionals provides quite a key to understanding what's going on.
Yeah. Relating to group races, because I think this is a good moment to fit this question in. Do you feel the current weight for age system is fit for purpose? I know, and I think it was Timeform did an analysis where it's clearly with time-based analysis you can see, the quality of 3-year-olds of a certain level versus older horses of a certain level, and I think their basic conclusion was that 3-year-olds receive too much weight in open group races. Is that something you have a view on?
Yeah, I was involved in that, and certainly have been in the past. I altered the weight price scale at Timeform a couple of times in my time there. Is it fit for purpose? It's more fit for purpose now than it used to be, the official one. It's still, the evidence is, even though it might seem rather academic most of the time, but the official allowance for 2-year-olds is way too large, which only comes into play in races like the Nunthorpe and only occasionally. But if you're doing things like time analysis and time comparisons between times of 2-year-olds and older horses, and imagining that they're 20 pounds less mature than older horses, you will be put away time and again.
Yeah.
So if you use weight for age, it definitely could do with being improved upon the BHA scale. There is an argument for not using weight for age, certainly in both time and form analysis. The reason why commercial organisations like Timeform absolutely understandably do factor it in is that you would spend an awful lot of time basically assuming that younger horses are maturing at a certain rate in any case, and having a general sort of scale that bumps them up as they get more mature is a better way of dealing with it than trying to handle it on the fly, as it were. But there's certainly something to be said for people who aren't producing ratings for public consumption for actually ignoring weight for age and just taking the weight that has been carried.
Do you find it's factored into the market where... Because 3-year-old, clearly there's a case by case basis situation here, but the 3-year-olds, because they are perhaps, I don't know, receiving more weight than they should be, the market tends to take cognizance of that, and they tend to go off. The price tends to be an accurate reflection, or do you think that information isn't well known enough that it's factored into the market?
There would be an answer to that, which would require crunching the numbers, and I can't give a definitive answer on that at the moment. I would say, though, that the effect of, say, 3-year-olds in handicaps between Royal Ascot and Doncaster St. Ledger meeting, you can see that the longer the distance of the race, the more that 3-year-olds win compared to chance, so impact values. And it's still there now. Sprints is fairly, there's close to parity. Mile and beyond horses, 3-year-olds win in handicaps anything up to 1.5 times as often as they, inverted commas, should do. So there's a kink in the weight for age there. There's something going on which means that 3-year-olds around that time, either because of maturity or simply because of the way they've been campaigned up until that point, obviously they might be trying longer distances and everything. So it's not adequately compensated for. The evidence is there. I would imagine that the BHA, who have taken on a data analyst to work in conjunction with their handicapping team, will be looking at that again, really. But it could just be that, that's one of the things that we just have to sort of accept, that around about midsummer and leading into autumn, that the less mature, less exposed horses suddenly come to the fore much more than they did otherwise.
And serve
a purpose of ensuring sort of a competitive racing across the generations, and justifies itself in that respect. And we're probably in the area now of, other than with 2-year-olds, where it's largely academic, we're sort of tinkering around the edges a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, certainly my reading it would be that perhaps, I mean, they'll certainly be aware of this, but, and you kind of hinted at that there, because they are looking to have a situation where the top class 3-year-olds are willing to step into open company and take on the top class 4-year-olds and the Eclipse or the King George. I guess they want to make it appealing for trainers of 3-year-olds for that to take place. I don't know if that, I mean, if that would be a fair assessment.
Yeah. The alternative, I think if you created horse racing from scratch, which it would be quite nice, but isn't going to happen, is that horses would only really truly be tested once they've reached, you know, the second half of their 4-year-old or 5-year-old careers, when they're fully mature and don't need weight for age allowances, and that maybe 3-year-old racing would become a little bit like 2-year-old racing. But given where we are and that 3-year-old career is seen as the classic season, in order to test those 3-year-olds against horses outside their generation, you need to have some sort of allowance. And weight for age does it sometimes imperfectly, but generally fairly well. And at least we all know where we stand with it. If you think that 3-year-olds are going to do particularly well in the Arc de Triomphe or something like that, you can back accordingly, and the evidence will be there for you to assess.
No, I think that's, yeah. I mean, I suppose the system, as you say, is it's at least open and transparent, and people know what they're signing up for. So it has that merit, at least. I'll take another, just taking a look through some of the questions we've been asked. This is a kind of form-based question. So this person's asked how to compare sectional performances across distances. They're asking if you have finishing speeds and closing sectionals, how easy is it to accurately compare the quality of a 7-furlong performance with, say, a mile performance, or a 10-furlong performance with a 12-furlong performance, assuming that these races have been run on the same day? From your own perspective, is that something that can be done with a degree of accuracy?
I believe so. And they don't need to be run on the same day. The whole point of any ratings system, or, you know, whether it's sectionally based or form-based or whatever, is to be able to compare horses under different circumstances. I think racing would just be a interesting social day out and entertaining spectacle if we didn't have some sort of understanding of how good horses are that have never met previously. And that's what sectional ratings and sectional upgrades are trying to address. One of the things about sectional ratings, sectional upgrades, is that the finishing speed percentage thing is a ratio of a horse's performance. So 105% after the sectional, 96% before it, depending on the distances of those sectionals, for example. And therefore, it's applicable more widely. So when you see a horse running quicker than par at 7 furlongs, it can be compared with a horse running quicker than par at 8 furlongs. There's a little bit of sort of mathematical juggling sometimes needs to go on, but it's a myth that sectionals only apply in the circumstances under which they happened. Many decades ago, people understood that you had needed standard times in order to assess overall times, and overall times are, in a way, one large sectional. It's still time analysis, it's still the length of time it takes a horse to travel a certain distance, and standard times are different at Ascot than they are at Epsom, and different for 5 furlongs than they are for a mile. And particularly in this era of easy access to data, it should be possible to get that pretty close to right and to be able to make those comparisons. Obviously, if you're dealing with a horse who's shown good finishing speed at 7 furlongs and a horse that's shown good finishing speed at 8 furlongs, when they meet, it may favour one or the other in terms of the distance they ran over, but that's something over and above the actual sectional performance that they've put up in that context.
That kind of leads nicely into something I was, from my own perspective, keen to discuss. And I don't know, and I'm sure it's something you do to one degree or another, but I think there's certainly a perception that you can only use sectional times to analyse pace or overall performance or ground, but certainly something I've started to do probably in the last 2 or 3 years over jumps and on the flat is using that data in order to provide a complete profile of a horse and to identify, you know, the conditions in which they are most likely to perform to their optimum. I mean, an example would be, you know, horses struggling to travel over a strongly run shorter distance, perhaps needing longer, or horses who lack the tactical speed to quicken over another distance, perhaps needing further. And I've kind of got to a stage now where Simon teased me slightly for for still using the Racing Post, but I've got a kind of basic idea of certainly top grade horses, the optimum conditions in which they in my mind need to perform, and I think that's something you can't really do without a knowledge of pace and a knowledge of, you know, the horses quickening and so on and so forth. Is that something you've ever done or something you do yourself, Simon?
Yeah, a number of points. One, I'm glad you mentioned jumps. We're speaking in early September and I'm tending to concentrate on things to do with the flat, but I've found that jump racing is far too few people place sufficient store by pace. And that there's a lot of mileage in understanding what's going on in races through sectionals and through pace over the jumps, whichever way you do it, whether it involves sectionals or not. In terms of sort of profiling the strengths and weaknesses of individual horses, I do that. I would say, and I'm not just saying this because I'm talking to you, I think you've done more in that area than I have, really. From reading the stuff you put out, and more detailed sort of number crunching of sectionals over jumps as well than I have. I'm trying to get an idea of the ability, but also sort of the reliability of the form. But out of that does fall, you know, do I think if a horse like, and I'll give another flat example here just to counter what I've been saying, but a horse like Anthony Van Dyke were to run in a 7-furlong race where I didn't think he was going to get a good lead, I would be looking to oppose him. Now, it all depends on price, it all depends on what is up against him, but he appears a horse who's capable of putting up a really good performance at 7 furlongs, but almost certainly only when he gets good pace, fairly contesting conditions, and I think he's not demonstrated speed so far, and if he were to meet speedy horses, I think he could be in trouble. But that's not to say he's not a good horse. So at that kind of level, but less so sort of lower down the racing echelons, then I definitely do use sectionals to provide me with evidence about the strengths and weaknesses of horses, both flat and jumps.
And I think that's something we're keen to emphasise about synthesising the information and being in a position where, because, and I'll give you an example where you quite rightly corrected me. It was from C of Class 1, so it would be 10 days ago or so, and I made the point about Coronet struggling to quicken in a steadily run race. Certainly that was visually was the impression I got, but you made a very, very good point and got me thinking again about the horse that she was capable of running around 11 seconds, which for a horse who's, you know, a 12 furlong specialist is pretty fast, in a steadily run race in France, and therefore, you know, it perhaps wouldn't be accurate to suggest that Coronet, you know, really needs a strongly run race to perform to her optimum. So it's about kind of looking beyond perhaps what's, you know, obvious to your eye and you're using that information to to further your understanding of horses and their and the individual conditions they need to perform. Because certainly I think anybody visually watching Coronet in the Yorkshire Oaks would have thought she was slow to quicken, you know, she took time to hit top speed. But if she's capable of running an 11-second sectional in a slowly run race, well then maybe does that just suggest that the horse is, you know, not able to perform to that level on every occasion, or perhaps just didn't want to be in front or whatever. And
I think it's an example where I might have been technically correct, but I'd taken the wrong conclusion. I sided with Coronet that day. She'd been slow to quicken in the past. I had placed a lot of store by that race in the Grand Prix de Saint-Cloud, I think, where she was beaten the nose by Volgeist, who's not the quickest thing on four legs himself either, but where they had 112% finishing speed and absolutely burnt it up in the home straight. That appears to have been a bit of a one-off with her, I'm afraid, and perhaps more typically, that performance in the Yorkshire Oaks is more typical of the Coronet we've generally got to know. But I think there are reasons other than simple lack of speed behind that. Sorry I interrupted you there, Will.
No. That yeah, she's certainly quirky, I think, which was perhaps something I hadn't really taken into account. I mean,
I thought she'd changed her spots, as it were, this year. She'd won the Middleton Stakes, again, shown a fair bit of speed, showed lots of speed in France, as well as a high head carriage. And I think she's now beginning to revert to the kind of horse she was. Talented, generally runs well, so not knocking her, but possibly likes to follow other horses.
Yeah, no, I think that's probably fair. I mean, and that race is probably a good example of what we're talking about in terms of profiling horses. I mean, I did a short, a kind of 8-10 minute podcast on Sea of Class and why there were people talking about why they thought she would be better in a strongly run race, and my take was, well, for one thing, you can't say that for certain because she's never been tested under those conditions, but because Sea of Class is very much of the Kingman style, where her strength seems to be her ability to go from travelling speed to top speed, that conditions that place less of an emphasis on that, i.e. a strongly run race, it would be less likely to suit her. And whereas there are other horses, and again, I gave the example at the time of, say, Golden Horn, who perhaps wasn't the quickest to go from travelling speed to top speed, but when he hit that top speed, he was able to sustain it for kind of a longer period of time than others were. So it's kind of, from my perspective, it's about finding the conditions a horse best needs to perform and betting them accordingly in those conditions, and perhaps taking them on where the conditions are likely to be against them. And again, I mean, I know that's something you'll do to one degree or another, but I think people perhaps have a perception that you can only use time to analyse you know, the pace of a race or the overall quality of performance. But I think you can actually, yeah, you can definitely use it to profile a horse in that kind of way. And that's something I would certainly be keen to emphasise.
Yeah, absolutely. I think everybody, because I do have quite a lot of visuals boys friends, or they used to be friends, I'm not sure if they still are after some of my remarks. They do that. They do that better than I do. What I do feel is you can be put away by visuals, and the thing about sectionals is it provides evidence, so that if you thought Sea of Class was running past horses who were stopping at the end at York, you're wrong, but you can at least prove that you were wrong or that you're right in a certain circumstance by putting hard figures behind it. And I mean, I've worked with an awful lot of race readers, some very good race readers. I think the people who work at Timeform are the best race readers in the business, not least because they do pay reference to sectionals where they're known anyway. But every one of the good race readers, including myself, if I can put myself in that bracket, occasionally gets put away by by what they see. Time doesn't lie, even though our interpretation of it sometimes is wrong.
That kind of leads me on to a question I was keen to ask, and I haven't given you any forewarning of this, but I've been victim of it somewhat as well, and I know you have too. Why do you think there is, even amongst people who would consider themselves, you know, quite serious punters, why do you think there is this kind of decrying of sectionals and the analysis it provides? The two kind of hypotheses I have is one, that people simply don't understand it, but I wonder if, too, and it's something you kind of touched on there, because race reading and form study as a process is largely subjective, I wonder if it's people feel uncomfortable with factoring something in which is objective in a field where race reading generally is a subjective process. I don't know if there's any merit in that kind of idea.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think there are some people who just see it as a threat to people in the media, perhaps, who see it as a threat to their ability just to chuck unsubstantiated opinions out there and never be held to account. So the whole kind of evidence-based thing that sectionals is an example of threatens to undermine their positions. But they're fairly small in number, but unfortunately pretty influential within racing. As I said, I know people who are very successful punters who pay almost no recognition of sectional timing, but they do definitely factor in pace. I'm not really sure why they're occasionally antagonistic towards it, but I think one of the things is that they feel probably correctly that they can get it right often enough. They're very expert at race reading and of understanding pace. They can get it right often enough that it's not actually worth all the extra effort that undoubtedly goes into compiling sectionals and understanding sectionals. They're prepared to take the occasional hit when they sometimes misinterpret a race that they might have been able to have got right with a bit more evidence. But it seems like a lot of people in racing are a little bit defensive about their kind of area of expertise. I've probably been guilty of stirring the pot a little bit with creating a dichotomy between sectionalistas and visuals boys. It's a bit of fun, really. But, you know, perhaps the most important thing to take away from any of these podcasts, I would think, is that there are areas of expertise that you can become familiar with, but the important thing, really important thing, is to synthesize lots of different things and not to concentrate just on one area. I think sectionals are a very important part of that conversation. I also think there's a lot of people who probably in school and beyond look at numbers and just don't really get excited by them. I find that ridiculous, but that's what a lot of people are like. In contrast, I think that far from being a dull thing to undertake crunching numbers, whether it's form ratings or sectional times, I actually think it's a fascinating part of understanding what's going on, what may go on, to understand the context of horse racing and the various subplots, whether horses, and undoubtedly good horses, going to be able to show the turn of foot that it needs to win a slowly run race and things like that. And if it weren't for sectionals, I'm not sure my enthusiasm for the sport I've been involved in for 40 odd years would be anything like as great as it is now. And I'd love more people to understand that that's what sectional timing and other forms of analysis can bring to the party, that it can really enhance the whole appreciation of the sport and of the history of the sport as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you've put that beautifully. I mean, I think that this is a good point to end on as well. I mean, adding ineloquently from my own perspective, sectionals weren't what got me interested in racing, but I think, like you, it has sustained and deepened my interest in a way that if this information wasn't available, that I wouldn't have perhaps become as deeply involved in the sport. And your work and the work of people at Timeform and others out there, I think you might feel underappreciated at times, but I think there is for a lot of people, it has played a big part in getting them interested in the sport and keeping them interested in the sport, and I don't think there can really be much higher praise than that.
Wow, that's wonderful to hear. I hope it's correct. Thanks for saying that.
There's one or two other questions that we've been asked that we haven't had time to cover, but particularly related to the going stick and using time to analyse the true state of going. If Simon's agreeable to come on the podcast again, that's perhaps something we could cover in more depth then, because it's something that almost merits 10-15 minutes worth of discussion and time that we perhaps don't have here. So if I can entice Simon to come back on when he has a spare couple of hours in the future, that's maybe something we'll cover then.
Yeah, that sounds a good idea. I'm big believer in using time analysis in that area.
Definitely, and it's something, I mean, I have to say I'm slightly guilty of only having not doing that kind of analysis myself, so I think it would be something I would certainly learn plenty from as well. I think that's a good point to close on. Huge thanks to Simon for taking the time and coming on. As I've said in other podcasts, I tend to see a good litmus test of the quality of a podcast being that somebody in my position who's reasonably well up and informed on something, having things that they can take away and learn from that podcast. And I've certainly got a couple of things that Simon said there that I'm going to have to think a bit more deeply about and factor in that perhaps I haven't in the past. And I hope that I've managed to get to most of the questions as well. We've got some good guests coming up that I won't, who have agreed in principle to appear. More on that, I'll maybe post them on Twitter, but the aim would be to have a podcast each week, certainly up until November. And yeah, if we could get Simon on for another podcast, a follow-up podcast, that would be fantastic. So yeah, thanks again for coming on, Simon.
Thanks Will, been enjoyable, and good luck with the rest of it. You're doing a great service here.
Well, it's kind of you to say. And yeah, thanks again for everybody for engaging on Twitter and for the questions. It's certainly been useful for incorporating them into the podcast, and there's definitely been things I would have missed had it not been for the questions. So that's been excellent. Okay, thanks guys. See you again next week. Bye.